let's jump in. Chris Rufo, thanks for being with us on the American Experiment podcast.
It's great to be with you.
I want to start, Chris, by talking about your book, America's Cultural Revolution: How the Radical Left Conquered Everything. It's a terrific book. And what it does is it traces how it was that the radical left, kind of when people were not paying attention, they seem to have taken over just about every institution in American life. What's the kind of Cliff's Notes version of how they did that?
Yeah, great. That's exactly right. And so the big bookends for this story are 1968, which I use as the point of origin, and then 2020, which was the point of conquest. And so people in 2020, as BLM, George Floyd, defund the police, all of these movements came to this big culminating point. DEI, critical race theory, all of these ideologies seem to have grabbed hold of all of our institutions simultaneously. I just tried to peel back the layers of the onion to show where did these ideas come from, how were they transmitted over time, and how is it that the racial radicalism of the 1960s suddenly was installed in your Fortune 100 HR program, in your child's K through 12 curriculum, and then of course in elite universities. And so the goal of the book was simply to tell that story, to tell it narratively, dramatically, historically, using some of the key personalities as tent poles to help the reader get through the sequence of history.
So your book is divided into four sections, and each one is associated with the person. The first one, called Revolution, Herbert Marcuse is the central figure, and he's kind of the theorist for the whole new left movement that's now kind of taken over the country.
Yeah, that's right. I think, Marcuse, of course, you could, for lack of a better term, critical theorist is probably true. I think neo-Marxist is maybe more descriptive for the people in the American context. He was the theorist of the new left, which has kind of since metamorphosized into what we now think of as like the BLM left or the woke left. But Marcuse was brilliant, and we have to give him some credit. Certainly, having spent time reading about his life, but also reading his key works, I mean, truly a brilliant man, and had some great insights, even if his ideas ultimately, I think, are destructive. And it's actually interesting because those of us on the right, there's like this, there's this great kind of school of thought coming from Leo Strauss on the right. And in a way, Herbert Marcuse is the analogous figure on the left. And I think both of them, are probably, pound for pound as far as intellect, brilliant people. And so it's always been kind of a fascinating parallel for me to think about this, that these are, people that had this kind of European, continental European mode of scholarship, kind of brilliant minds that were transplanted into the United States, and then had a tremendous impact on how we think about politics.
Among other things, Marcuse is really the prophet who talked about the revolution that would come, not from the working class, which he hated, but from above, to be imposed by elites, which is what we have seen over the recent past.
Yeah, he was, and I think that he was in some ways realistic. I mean, he never gave in on his ultimate ideals, which were unrealistic, but in his tactical approach, he did have a dose of realism. And so he saw very clearly in even the 50s that the Soviet Union was kind of sclerotic, undynamic, repressive, and bankrupt. To his credit, again, he wrote a book in the 1950s explaining why the Soviet Union had already failed at that very early point. And then likewise, he saw the in Europe, and especially in the United States, the working class, the middle class, was totally uninterested in revolution. Actually, the working class life was getting much better under the capitalist system. And so instead of kind of jettisoning his philosophical priors, his mind was searching for what point of entry could he find for these ideas. And he found really like a two-part proletariat, and that is really the basis of the left's coalition today. It's kind of white intellectuals, kind of the stratum of the kind of university educated bourgeois intellectuals at the top of the coalition, and then disenfranchised racial minorities at the time, predominantly Black, kind of city dwellers and kind of disaffected urban class. And he thought that you could combine those two groups together and then they would be the force of revolution. And in some ways, he wasn't wrong. In some ways, he was actually correct, again, because that is still the basic kind of 1.0 version of the left's coalition that we've seen to this day.
And then the second section of your book focuses on how this whole leftist structure got, how race became the key element in this structure. And the person that you used to kind of embody that is Angela Davis, who by rights should have gone to prison for murder.
Yeah, she absolutely should have. You know, I reviewed, you know, court records, I reviewed, you know, reports and other documents related to the Marin courthouse siege, where she had, you know, really by her own admission and by documented evidence, provided the weapons that were used in, you know, what we could describe as like a jailbreak, like a hostage taking in the interest of breaking free some Marxist radicals from prison, unsavory guys who had been committed of violent crimes already. And so she was totally implicated in this. And yet, you know, as we've seen over and over, another pattern that I think has emerged, the jury was quite sympathetic to her because she represented a victim class. She represented a kind of way of sticking it to the man. And even one of the little anecdotes that just bowled me over that I found in my research in one of the newspaper reports from that time period was, you know, they asked one of the jurors, you know, why did you vote to acquit? And he said something along the lines of, you know, we stand in solidarity with the kind of Marxist radicalism against this white supremacist America. And then they all attended a rock concert afterwards. So the jurors and the, you know, all of the Angela Davis supporters then went off and celebrated together. And so you get a sense of the racial politics that, of course, they've changed over time. In some ways better, in some ways worse. But there's a kernel of what we see now already at that point. Again, this is post-Civil Rights Act, but really, you know, pre-woke, but I think more accurately described as proto-woke.
Then the third section of your book focuses on education, and of course, in the long march through the institutions, taking over essentially all of post-secondary education has been, you know, one of the major triumphs of the left. And the guy that you talk about here is one that I wasn't even familiar with, a Brazilian named Paulo Freire, if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Paulo Freire is, and it's quite interesting because most people are not familiar with him. He's not a household name by any means. But according to academic databases, he's the third most cited scholar or pseudo scholar in all of the social sciences. And so his influence cannot be underestimated. And there were some surveys not too long ago that showed that he was, you know, among the most assigned texts, or even the most assigned text in graduate schools of education. So kind of the diploma mills that mint new teachers in the American K-12 system. And so he's another interesting figure. You know, certainly an import, let's say. He came from Brazil. He spent actually not much time in the United States, although he did a stint at Harvard and then was an organizer and then worked for some, you know, American-led charities abroad. But he was an unrepentant communist. He thought the Chinese Cultural Revolution was in the 80s, even in the 80s when the legacy of the Chinese Cultural Revolution was well known, he was still a defender of what happened in Mao's China. And you know, lo and behold, you kind of move forward over time, and these ideas, this idea of using the school as a revolutionary recruiting base, have gotten even more popular and even more pervasive.
Well, one thing that's happened is that it's taken over K-12 education, as you say, in part certainly through the teachers' colleges and so on, training programs, and we see that in Minnesota. You know, critical race theory has taken over the public schools. We now have the ethnic studies component that we borrowed from California. And the goal of public education now is to turn kids into left-wing activists.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we've seen that, you know, starting in 2020, that was the focus of a lot of the reporting that I did. in that 2020, 2021 period. And that was really, in a lot of ways, the reason that I wrote the book is because I was doing this reporting, showing people, hey, this is what's happening in K through 12 classrooms. This is the ideology that is being propagated by the institutions. And it sparked my own curiosity to say, oh, you know, I really should do a deep dive and actually uncover beyond just the headlines, beyond just the, you know, the Fox News hits that I was doing, to actually say, hey, give people a more three-dimensional understanding of what this is. So rather than just, you know, 3 minutes in a radio interview or a TV interview, going into it at depth and at length to substantiate the case that we're making, because part of the difficulty that we have in politics and policy, let's say, is that you know, we have to make the case with few resources at our disposal. So let's say we're challenging critical race theory. Well, critical race theory has its own departments or sub-departments in dozens of universities around the country. It has, you know, 10,000 or more scholarly papers published every, you know, every kind of cycle of this fad. And we have, you know, by contrast, almost nothing. And so I think you have to do, you know, better work, you know, deeper work, more detailed work, to substantiate this and get get the argument through the criticism, the smear campaigns, and then the kind of walls of denial. And so that was part of the motivation for writing the book, and part of the reason I think it was successful.
Well, in 2021, our organization, American Experiment, did a major campaign, well, starting in 2020 and really continuing to the present. But in 2021, we did a 23-city tour of the state of Minnesota, putting on programs about critical race theory, how it was infiltrating the public schools and why it was bad. We got national publicity, international publicity even. We had armed guards at all of the events after the first couple. And
Wow.
over a period of time, we battled this every day for 3 years. Over a period of time, we got over 40,000 public comments filed in opposition to the social studies standards and then the ethnic studies strand that were being proposed by the Governor Tim Walz administration. And we got some changes made in the standards, but ultimately, notwithstanding that public opposition, they have gone into effect. And so the fight continues. But you're right. It's groups like ours that have to take on, you know, this behemoth of the left.
Yeah, that's right. And even such, it's as you point out, it's very difficult. And so, and I'll tell you one thing that I've learned in the practical work that I've done in recent years is, you know, and winning the election is important, right? But winning the election is only the beginning. Winning the election is a kind of price of entry. And even if you've won the election, even if you have the governor's mansion, even if you have a majority in the state legislative bodies, nothing is guaranteed, and actually doing battle with these institutions is quite difficult. And so, certainly in a state like Minnesota, which is trending, you know, blue in recent years, that problem is very difficult. And what these folks believe is that they can buck parents in schools at the local level, they can buck you know, kind of protests from voters at the state level, and that they could just push these ideologies through, knowing that they have in their mind a comfortable margin where they can, you know, survive some of the challenge and ultimately, you know, promote the ideology within the education system, which in their theory will create more pliant and more amenable voters in the future.
The fourth section of your book is called Power, and the individual that it focuses on is Derrick Bell, who I know or knew at least years ago. I had him as a first-year law student at Harvard teaching criminal law. And so this is long before
Oh,
Derrick was
wow.
famous. I had it was you could not foresee at that time that he was going to become this kind of important historical figure.
How was his class? I'd be curious. Yeah.
It was okay. You know, he was obviously a liberal. He was in educational terms, you know, he was kind of a squish. He seemed like a nice enough guy. You know, it was okay.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, he certainly did, and it's quite interesting too, because he became very influential much later in life, and then his ideas changed also. And so you can even trace it in his scholarly work. So in the late 60s, early 70s, when he was first, becoming a professor, he wrote a big case book. I mean, he was writing, kind of legal scholarship and in a serious way, even if he was a man of the left, certainly. But over the course of the next, 30 years, 40 years, he drifted into this kind of racial nihilism and racial paranoia, and racial hatred that you see seeping through. And so, from what the evidence shows, and certainly the research that I did for his profile in the book, his teaching got worse over time, and to the point where he was a guest teacher at Stanford for a stretch, and Stanford decided to actually kind of provide supplementary teaching to his class because the students were not getting even the basics. He was just ranting and raving, kind of political opinion, instead of teaching them, con law or whatever he was teaching at the time.
But he's the intellectual father, really, of critical race theory.
Yeah, I mean, more than the intellectual father, I mean, he was the actual father figure or mentor to all of the young lawyers, law school students, and then law professors who established the discipline. And so the discipline started at a conference, like, many academic endeavors. They had a little conference. And Derrick Bell, these were all connected to Derrick Bell. They were all his students and mentees. Derrick Bell was at the conference where they coined the term critical race theory and where they decided to launch this, scholarly program. It was explicitly racially segregated. There were no white law students or law professors allowed. They were barred from participation. And from that kind of early moment, they started this academic discipline that, look, I mean, one of the interesting things in the book is that if you look at Angela Davis essentially had all of the concepts and all of the main lines of argument that you would find in critical race theory back in the late 60s, early 70s. She'd already established virtually the whole, the whole theory, which was just taking some Marxist ideas, translating it onto the racial plane or racial dimension. The critical race theorists, they didn't really innovate intellectually at all. They had some new terminology. They refined some of the concepts that you'd find in Davis. But what they really did well was just seek positions. And so while Angela Davis was, employed as a professor, she was marginal for her entire academic career. Now the critical race theorists, like let's say, broadly understood, are dominant in many departments and at many universities. And so their only innovation was essentially, using the tools at their disposal, affirmative action, DEI, office politics, racial guilt, and kind of some hard-edged, activist tactics to secure their own employment, which in my view, they mistook for like the supremacy of their ideas. No, they had bureaucratic supremacy, administrative supremacy. But I don't think by any stretch they had a kind of intellectual supremacy, I don't think that they won the debate in the ways that they imagined. And in fact, as we actually surfaced all of this in 2020, 2021, 2022, they lost the debate for public opinion decisively. We turned the critical race theory concepts, narratives, even the moniker itself, very, very negative, 2-to-1 opposition, in public opposition. And I think that they know that because even, these folks are a little bit older now, but in some of their conferences subsequent to that, 2022, 2023, even amongst themselves, they were admitting essentially, oh man, we got smoked by these kind of right-wing critics. So that was something that I thought was kind of a fun twist to the story.
In the march through the institutions, to me, the weirdest thing is the fact that these doctrines, DEI, which is just the, a new name for critical race theory, really, came to dominate corporate America. How did that happen? That just seems so strange to me. Companies have to compete, they're accountable to their customers. How did it happen that the left took over most of corporate America?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's interesting, and we shouldn't overstate it. So, corporate America is still run on, money, right? It's still a profit-driven, or at least a money-driven enterprise. That's true. I mean, you spend time in companies, like that's the what people are optimizing. There are a couple of reasons, though, where you have these left-wing ideologies that are layered on top of it. One is actually pretty simple. It's a legal reason. Affirmative action, disparate impact, 91 Civil Rights Act, the EEOC, civil rights kind of enforcement generally. Companies, to protect themselves from even spurious claims, they have adopted a lot of this kind of HR language that's then turned very left-wing because of who works in HR. That's one reason. The second reason is after 2020, public opinion was shifting pretty dramatically, and they sensed a vulnerability and that they had to do something. And the do something that they settled on was DEI. Oh, we have to do something. Look at us, we're doing DEI. Don't hurt us, was essentially the message. And then the third reason is just simple fashion. I mean, part of it is just simple fashion. You have a lot of young employees at these companies. It's very fashionable. It's very kind of high status. And the executives, who probably should know better, cave to the employees, to the media, to other pressure points, and then, they could take what is like a dismal business. Let's just say you're some, industrial company, you're doing industrial chemicals or something. I mean, it's not like you go to a dinner party and someone is like, "Tell me more about industrial chemical processing. That's fascinating." I mean, no one cares. These are money-making enterprises, but they're not status-generating enterprises. And so for executives, like let's say Walmart had a very bad reputation for many years. And so the CEO of Walmart, who says, "I'm going to do $100 million to open our new critical race theory center," he's not doing it because the voters of Bentonville and Arkansas want him to do it. He's not doing it because it improves the profitability of Walmart. He's doing it so that when he goes to, Vail, Colorado in the winter, he doesn't have to explain to people that he imports cheap Chinese goods and sells them to kind of down-class Americans in Walmart superstores on the edge of town. He can say, the business is really has a vision of being a pioneering company for racial justice, whatever. And I think that a lot of that is should not be underestimated. The making things fashionable creates a very cheap but powerful incentive. And I think that explains a lot of what's happened in the last 5 years.
One thing that happened after your book came out is the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in the North Carolina and Harvard cases, in which they said, no, the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act mean what they say, and you're not supposed to engage in race discrimination. That was a powerful marker the Supreme Court put down. And I think there has been some real retrenchment, not in academia, but in corporate America, because they can see the handwriting on the wall, right? The same principle is going to be applied to employment law as to college admissions, I think. And so, what do you think about that? Are we seeing corporate America pulling back?
We are absolutely, and I think that there's more room to go. And I think now it's a question of enforcement. I mean, look, everyone knows the 14th Amendment, and I think the original clear language of the Civil Rights Act of 64 means that you treat people equally as individuals, and you don't, put your thumb on the scales based on their racial ancestry. That still is the best policy, but companies have because of how this. In how the law has changed in part, but how really enforcement has changed, they brazenly discriminate, and college admissions the same. By itself, look, a change and I'll defer on the legal analysis to you. I'm not a lawyer, but on the practical side, a change in the Supreme Court decision is good, but it doesn't change anything unless it's enforced, because those enforcement mechanisms have to be there. And so we have to get states, and then, with a change in administration, the federal government actually saying, "No, you will pay a price if you violate this," and rescind some of the executive orders on affirmative action, rescind some of the legal excuses people have to violate the principle of colorblind equality. And then I think you'll get a kind of more welcoming reception in corporate America. Look, most people that run big companies don't want to play the racial favoritism game. They don't want to play, the DEI game. They want to focus on building great companies. And we should set the incentives so that that's what they're focused on. And to the extent that they play this kind of racial discrimination game, they should be punished quickly and swiftly. so that they realize, oof, the risk is now on the other side. Because right now for them, the risk is only on one side. I think you have to counterbalance the risk so that they, move back to the center. On the optimistic side, though, as you suggest, this is already happening. I mean, this is already happening slowly but steadily in corporate America, and I think there's a lot more, that could be accomplished.
One thing that's come to the fore just in the last year or two is the anti-Semitism that is one aspect of this whole left-wing CRT DEI ideology. And I think it's shocked a lot of people. How does that fit into the bigger picture?
It did shock a lot of people, including it shocked me, frankly. I was surprised by it. It was a kind of dormant, let's call it like a dormant ideology on left and on right. I mean, it seemed like of many of the issues in American life, there was a kind of bipartisan agreement, or a bipartisan consensus, which was, strong support for Israel on foreign policy, and then a strong kind of taboo against anti-Semitism in culture domestically. And then, all of a sudden that really shifted after after the Hamas terror attack. And it really shifted dramatically online on the left, or rather dramatically in academia on the left. And then to a lesser extent online on the right, we've seen some kind of resurgence of some anti-Semitic like social media content. And so this was a surprise to me, and I think it was a surprise to many people. And the most surprising part was that it was coming from very elite quarters, where those attitudes, one had thought previously were not permissible. And yet you have, I remember when that first happened, you'd have thousands of college professors, Ivy League professors, flagship state university professors, signing these statements saying, no, Israel is responsible for the terror attack against its own citizens. And I remember thinking, wow, I mean, this is a really crazy thing that is happening. And those professors paid no price, but they did give us some valuable information that this ideology, this attitude, is like it was really in the late 1960s when left-wing Marxists in the United States supported the PLO, overseas and their kind of terror campaigns in Europe. And so it shouldn't have been a surprise. Perhaps I was naive and others were naive, but now certainly the record is clear.
Let me suggest this connection, Chris. See what you think of it. It was Al-Qaeda and the Iranian mullahs who coined the idea that we have the great Satan and the little Satan. Great Satan is America, little Satan is Israel. If you fast forward now to what's being taught in K through 12 public schools under the CRT regime, one of the common buzzwords is settler colonialism. And the great evil of world history, to hear these people tell it, is settler colonialism. Well, of all the invasions and migrations of the last 4,000 years, as far as I can see, there's only two instances that these leftists teach of settler colonialism. One of them is the United States, and the other is Israel. And so our public schools, it seems to me, have largely adopted the great Satan, little Satan model that was pioneered by Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder though. I think it's kind of originally from the Iranian mullahs, no, in the kind of 79 period, and so, and I wonder if it becomes if it actually came about before that. I don't know. I don't know the history of that idea, but certainly it's for different reasons. That's the other thing. Like, there's this argument on the right where people say, oh, how can you have queers for Palestine? Because if you're gay or transgender and you go to Palestine, they'll throw you off a roof or bash your head in with a rock. Ha ha ha, that's a totally logically contradictory sentiment, and therefore doesn't have any validity or it kind of doesn't work. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess certainly it doesn't make any sense logically, but if you think of it, kind of on another basis, not a logical basis, but a political basis, it makes perfect sense where you have, let's say, trans activists and Iranian mullahs, they hate the same people. They want to see the same people destroyed. And so, for the time being, they can even set aside maybe their differences, and they have the same enemies, and the same enemies for different reasons, right? The kind of fundamentalist theological basis for the mullah's hatred of the United States is a little bit different than, let's say the radical trans activists or left wing, Marxist, Western Marxist. But they always find a way somehow to meet in the middle, right? And so, like I was saying, you saw that even in the 70s, where you'd have Palestinian terror groups meeting with, the black Marxists from the United States, meeting with, European kind of homegrown, white European left-wing groups like the equivalent of the Weather Underground, the Baader-Meinhof complex, or the kind of Red Faction, Red Brigade, in Europe. And so it's like a motley crew of people who share the same hatred. And look, in politics, that's often enough. And you can set aside some of those other, logical problems for another day.
One of the signal moments in the whole anti-Semitism aspect of this situation came when the three elite college presidents, university presidents, testified before a congressional committee. And that spun out into a real disaster for them. Claudine Gay, the president of Harvard, got fired. You played a significant part in that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, certainly. It was the Claudine Gay story was a two-part story. She got herself into hot water with her disastrous response to anti-Semitism on campus at Harvard. She equivocated. She, failed to really create any moral distinction between Israel and Hamas. And then she, in this testimony before Congress, said that if students were advocating to wipe to kill Israelis or wipe Israel off the map, she wasn't sure if that violated Harvard policy or not. So like a direct incitement to violence, and so that was the predicate. And then the conclusion came about because of that general problem. And then through luck, another reporter and I came into contact with a dossier that had evidence that Claudine Gay had plagiarized huge sections of her thesis. And then another reporter in our circle discovered that she'd also plagiarized many other academic works. And so you had this plagiarism crisis that, look, if you're an academic, your reputation at the very minimum should be that you don't plagiarize, that you produce your own academic work. I mean, that's like the standard in any good middle school or high school or certainly undergraduate. In a graduate program, you should be kicked out immediately and your PhD denied. And when you're president of Harvard, you should meet a bare minimum academic standard. And so all of these things combined put enough pressure on her that the corporation, the Harvard corporate members of the Harvard Corporation, felt that they had no other choice but to pressure her to resign. And so I think it's a big moment. I think it shows that these institutions are not invulnerable, that these institutions are not immune to public pressure, and that ultimately, they're at least over time, perhaps could be corrected in some of their grave errors. Not easily, not quickly, not surely, but that I think it opened up a new possibility of seeing some reform.
A lot of people, Chris, have referred to you as the most effective or the most successful conservative activist in America. What do you attribute that to? You've had scored a lot of successes, right?
I mean, part of it is good fortune, whether it's critical race theory or trans ideology in schools or DEI or Harvard and academic reform, what we did at New College of Florida, working with the governor to take it over and turn over the leadership. It's been a great few years, and we've had a lot of success. And when you have one success, you have this sneaking suspicion that it's luck, it's a fluke. You may not be able to repeat it. But we've been able to repeat it on a number of issues over time. And so I spend a lot of time thinking, like, all right, what works? what actually works in practice. And you know, what I see on the right, let's say, I see people engaging in like kind of very fine doctrinal disputes in almost like a medieval manner. You know, and it's like, and I see that stuff, and I always think, yeah, okay, great, but you know, what are you going to do about it? You know, and that simple question, what are you going to do about it? I found very effective at separating out kind of, you know, theory from action, let's say, or you know, speculation from kind of tangible, concrete victory, and so. I like to win. I like to win. And so I really orient all the things that I do towards that goal. And I like to have kind of concrete wins because I think it's like in business, you know, there's a, you know, you look at your balance sheet, right? So the company that makes money or the company that has, you know, the stock price go up, there's kind of an objective metric of success. Like you can measure it. You can, it's concrete, it's undeniable. You know, you can, you know, you can't fake it. And I think, you know, I like to think about, you know, political life and intellectual life in the same way. You know, I like to always think, you know, and I say this only because I've done it the other way. I was previously a documentary filmmaker, and you really have no idea if your work is impactful or important or means anything. You know, it's like everything is so intangible and vague. You have the suspicion correctly that it doesn't really mean much because it's like a fake kind of world that a lot of the arts inhabit, for example. And so I think, you know, part of the reason why I've been able to score victories is because I tried to do it. You know, it sounds very simple. It sounds almost like a truism or something that you shouldn't even say. It's so obvious. But I think that if you set, you know, you set out to notch a victory, you're more likely than if you don't think about it in those terms. And so, it's just fun for me and I enjoy it. And I think that's why, you know, if you enjoy something, you tend to get better at it.
That's the approach that we follow at American Experiment as well. Always looking for victories. One more subject before I let you go, Chris. You mentioned it briefly. I want to follow up New College. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. Here we have this failing, small, left-wing liberal arts school on the Gulf Coast in Florida, and Ron DeSantis decided to shake it up.
Yeah, I mean, Ron DeSantis is an incredible governor, an incredible leader, and an incredible person. And he, I think, is unique in not only his courage, not only his vision, but also his ability to implement policy and make it effective in the real world. And so, you know, working with him and learning from him and supporting his efforts, I really got a sense of his leadership style. And he's someone who understands how power works at the very administrative and detailed level. He knows legislation, he knows appointments, he knows regulation, he knows personnel, he knows legal compliance, he knows, you know, voter pressure, he knows media pressure. And so he has like a kind of a symphony conductor's vision of all the parts that have to move in order for your policies to actually be successful in the real world. And so one of these projects that I was, you know, lucky enough to help on was taking over New College, which was like Florida's left-wing, you know, burnout university, public university. You know, gender studies was the big intellectual focus. You know, the DEI department was flourishing, and then the professors were, you know, training, you know, student activists in a lot of ways. And it was failing. It was functionally insolvent. And certainly not meeting the expectations of taxpayers. And so rather than, you know, do nothing, which most governors would do, you know, he said, let's appoint a new board. Let's take it over. Let's turn over the entire leadership. And then let's abolish DEI. Let's shut down the gender studies program. Let's replace as much faculty as we can. And then let's turn it into a classical liberal university. that is more in line with the wishes of the people of Florida. And so we're now about 18 months into that experiment. And look, it's not easy. There have been ups and downs, but I think we're on the cusp of really showing that we've been able to turn this over in a short period of time with some dramatic results.
So you have an article just within the last few days, as we're speaking, in City Journal, talking about J.D. Vance as a vice presidential nominee, and you praised that selection and talked about Vance as part of the counter elite. Talk about that if you would.
Yeah, I think it's important because look, the populist movements fail to the extent that they remain, populist in nature, right? They can't secure a foothold on elite institutions or have a kind of an influence on elite culture or operate the machine of elite politics. And so that's always been true, and it's even more true now because we have a huge and complex society, and our elite institutions have much more influence than they've ever had before. And so, one of the challenges in the first Trump administration is that if you were, besides people that are in politics, like we have a different set of incentives, but if you were in business, academia, law, finance, high tech, in 2017 or 2018 or 2020 especially, you could not openly support Trump. You could not help advance Trump's agenda. You could not kind of move institutions towards that vision. You just couldn't do it. It was socially and culturally impossible. And so, one of the things that he has to do in the second administration, and I think he's poised to do, is to actually recruit people in those sectors that have influence, that have power, that have the ability to institutionalize his populist agenda. He's got to recruit them into the administration and then around the administration. And I think J.D. Vance is really poised to be at the center of that. He's of course got a great story, but also more importantly, he knows law, he knows finance, he knows tech. He's comfortable with those people, and they're comfortable with him. And I think he can help recruit that base of support for the president should they win, and make the administration much more effective because you can't win these fights as alone. You actually have to have a whole tier of people in a society that are fighting alongside you. And so or at the very least, not fighting you directly, not fighting against you. And I think JD Vance, I think JD could absolutely serve that function, and I hope that he does.
So, Chris, thanks very much for being with us. We'll leave it there.